Here is a sound that will take you back. The dial-up modem, the sound of progress 25 years ago. It signaled something really new, the World Wide Web.
1989 saw many dramatic changes, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the beginning of the breakup of the Soviet Union.
And the beginning of the end of the Cold War. Nelson Mandela prepared to leave prison.
Michael Jordan scored his 10,000th point in the NBA.
And we all were about to be launched from the real world into a vast virtual world.
Once you've learned how to get online yourselves, you'll start seeing web pages everywhere. TV shows have them, schools, Disney World, even the White House.
What's a web page? Something ducks walk on?
Ha ha, very funny.
Ha ha, David. That's from an instructional video called Kid's Guide to the Internet from the mid-1990s. Today, find a kid needing a guide to the Internet. From birth, it seems, it's now an integral part of our lives. And to explore how the web has evolved over these 25 years, we reached Kevin Kelly. He's one of the founders of Wired magazine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Take us back to 1989. What did you think of the web?
I have to say, my very first exposure to the web and seeing the first web pages was, oh, that's good. I have to say that it was not a revelation saying, oh my gosh, the world would never be the same. It just seemed a kind of a natural step. But within the next year or so, as the speed and acceleration of people bringing stuff on, when I saw how fast that was happening, that's when we realized, oh my gosh, this is going to change everything.
So I'm kind of wondering what the very early uses were for the web.
Well, it was geeky. And, you know, in the very beginning, nobody knew whether this was permanent. It seemed to almost be kind of more archive-ish, where people had a bunch of documents that they wanted to share with the world. And oftentimes there was a tendency to want to go there and kind of copy them. We had to be educated to the idea that it was like a library, that this was our memory, and that we could kind of go back to that site anytime and it will still be there.
Do you remember something that was thought that it would happen that just never did or never took off?
There was lots of surprises, and we got lots of things wrong about what we thought the web would become. In the very beginning, we actually know from some surveys that were done about what people expected the web to do or what they were going to use it for. They listed a kind of a list of very noble things, and they kind of, you know, started off very high-minded and descended down. So they were going to use it for educational purposes, for research, going to be electronic voting. There would be, you know, health information, and it would go all the way down. And at the very bottom would be kind of games and gossip and video. Well, 20 years later, 25 years later, that list is completely inverted. And the second thing that we got wrong in a big way, including Wired magazine where I was editing, was we all kind of expected this to be like television but better, like TV 2.0. And we were imagining 5 million channels of specialty information that was all going to be kind of produced by experts and TV channels and Time Warner and AOL and all the big media companies, and maybe lots of small media companies who are producing the saltwater aquarium channel, and et cetera. And we missed all the stuff that's going to be produced by the audience, by the users, by a gazillion small-time people producing YouTube videos or blogs or Twittering, that the entire content of it would be made by the prosumer, by the person who was producing it and watching it at the same time. That was the big thing that we missed in our expectations.
That is such a big idea. It's actually, in a way, not surprising that it wasn't predicted. But you yourself, back in the mid-80s, you were involved with a community called The Well. Tell us a little bit about The Well.
The Well started off with what they called at that time an online bulletin board, which meant that you dialed in a specific number and you were typing text, and everybody, you could read other people's text, and you could send email to someone else who was on that service. So all the services in the early 80s were the AOL and the Prodigy and CompuServe were little closed gardens. And the well allowed the users great freedom to start their own topics, to write whatever they wanted to write, and had a lot of interesting people. And so it became kind of an online salon or virtual community very, very quickly, because we kind of, again, let the users direct everything. And from that experience very early, I saw that this was one thing, a sharing economy. People were just going overboard to help each other in a way that we hadn't seen in a long time. And the second thing is that almost immediately the virtual citizens demanded to meet face-to-face. We had monthly well meetings. This was technology that wasn't kind of like industrial or steam engine-like and mechanical and alien. This was more organic. This was more human-like. This was more like an Amish barn raising. And that was a big thing for us in shifting our idea of what technology could be itself.
Although I wonder what you think now of people's massive use of social networks, where it does seem like the face-to-face is not often in the equation.
Yes. Right now, I think it's a little bit of a phase, like an adolescent phase. I think young people tend to do things with obsessions. And I think the internet was in its teenage adolescent phase, and we became obsessed with some of this. And I think as this generation gets older, I think they'll be less obsessed with this, and they'll even out and round out and have actually more face-to-face interaction than they are right now.
Well, that's interesting. Probably be encouraging to a lot of people. The idea that living our lives in a virtual reality is just a moment or a few years in time.
Yes, we're still very early in this. We're celebrating the 25th year of the web. Right now, in the history of the world, nothing has happened on the internet yet. I mean, we're at the beginning of the beginning. 20 years from now, we'll look back and we'll say, oh, nothing had happened by 2014. It all happened afterwards. And so the changes that we have seen in the last 25 years are going to pale compared to what's going to happen in the next 25 years.
Kevin Kelly is senior maverick at Wired Magazine, which he co-founded. He joined us to talk about the 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web. Thank you for joining us.
It was a real pleasure to be here.
And in case you haven't heard, we're on the World Wide Web. Check us out at npr.org.
I think most people know by now that serving in the military is hard work, and it can be hard on loved ones who are often managing challenges that people in the civilian world often do not face. According to the National Military Family Association, there are thousands of websites designed to help members of the military and their loved ones find resources like housing, counseling, and education. But the sheer amount of that information out there can be daunting. So the National Military Family Association, the NMFA, is out with a smartphone app called My Military Life. Here to tell us more about it is Michelle Joyner. She is the communications director for the NMFA. Couldn't have a military thing without an acronym, could you? Right?
Exactly. That's why we've moved away from it.
Okay. And she's here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Michelle, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us for additional perspective on the phone from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, is Laura Yates. She is a military spouse, and she also volunteers for the National Military Family Association. Laura, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, Michelle.
Michelle, can you start by telling us about some of the challenges that we're talking about here that this app is designed to address?
Certainly. You mentioned in your opening piece that they're just overwhelming resources. In the 12 years that this war has been going on, we've seen great community swell of support for military families. But when you do a quick Google search, you could get 10,000 results. And that type of information is paralyzing. And so where do you go? Who do you trust? What do you know what's best for you? We've been in this area supporting military families for over 40 years, and we used to answer these questions by phone, and then they became by email. And so it was like, well, now how can we scale this? And we need an app, because people are wondering about My husband's back from deployment, but my kids don't know him. My kids don't want to go to him. Is that normal? Is our relationship normal? Are these the things I should be experiencing? And so having a resource or a tool that lets you know what you should expect, what questions you should be asking, and where to go for help is what military families need.
And part is what you're doing, curating the information, because I would imagine that one of the things that would concern me is that how do you know what information there is valid? I mean, I think that there are a lot of people out there, frankly, and it's, you know, no one should be proud of this, who scam people who are in this field, and kind of because they realize that they've been disconnected from civilian life for a while, they've been disconnected from the kind of the routines for a while, and because there is so much information out there, are part of what you're doing curating the information to be sure that it's valid?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've been doing for 45 years. And we want to make sure that military families are using legitimate resources for them and that they are not falling through the cracks, that they're being plugged into the support services that were designed to protect them. And so we're taking in that information, we're evaluating where it's coming from, and making sure that folks are staying away from the scammers. That's one thing that we definitely know affects our community. And so if the Army's providing something for you, we want you to go to the Army. If it's your local church, that's where you should go.
Laura Yates, let's turn to you now. Your husband is a Master Sergeant in the 104th Airborne Division of the Army, so I want to thank him through you for his service. And I also want to thank you, because you are also serving. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
It does take the whole family to support these service members. Can you give us an example? I understand that you aren't sure that this is you're exactly the target audience for this, because you kind of have some miles on, right, in this service. But who do you think would benefit from this kind of thing?
Well, I think it would benefit all spouses, both new spouses and more seasoned spouses. From the new spouse perspective, I know when I married my husband, I was coming into a world that I really didn't understand. I didn't understand the rank structure of the Army per se. I didn't understand what services were available to me. So one good thing about the application, they have a section that's geared for new spouses. So you can go on there and learn about, oh, what do these acronyms mean? And what are the different ranks? And then you can learn about resources that are available on your post, like classes for new spouses, orientation classes. I mean, I know a lot of those new spouses don't know that. But also, more seasoned spouse like me, there is information that's relevant on there for me. My husband's actually going through a medical board to be transitioned out of the Army, and mm-hmm. there's a section on transition. That's not an area that I'm familiar with, because, you know, we didn't know we were going to have to transition. So there's information on there about that. And then also because of his medical condition, there's information about caregiver support. You know, I may have to support him in the future because of his condition. And so there's information about services available through the VA, and then also information about how to take care of myself as a caregiver mm-hmm. as I support him.
Let me co-sign that. You do need to take care of yourself. So we hope you will do that. What about that, Michelle? Is there taking care of yourself at the caregivers being taken care of themselves? Is that part of the service, part of the app?
Absolutely. Caring for the caregiver is definitely an area that we focus on, because we know that military families are oftentimes those people who are put in the caregiver role. We also recognize that military families are going to go through so many different events in their lifestyle. And so when you join, you need information on one thing. But then when you have kids, or when you move, or when you're experiencing a deployment, those all introduce new challenges to the military. And it doesn't have to be even war related. For instance, when you move, many military spouses don't know that in several states you're eligible for unemployment compensation. That's money that you paid into and now is out of your pocket. And so there are those types of information that's available through resources outside the government that military spouses should avail themselves of.
How do you, Michelle, assure yourself that the resources that you're identifying are, in fact, valid? Because I actually did a little test myself on to see where what comes up when I looked up a specific program. And I saw literally, just as you said, I saw like 10 different sites. And I think some of them were steering toward, you know, outdated forms and things of that sort. And I could see where that would be quite intimidating. You know, even for somebody like myself, I'm trained to look up information. I still found it kind of scary and overwhelming. So how do you assure yourself and the people who are using the app that the information is current, up to date, valid, and so forth?
Absolutely. And that's a great question and a concern for us. One of the the first things that we go to are definitely the resources that the military provides that are paid for by tax dollars and that we know are targeted to military families. If it's a nonprofit, we're looking at their charity ratings. We're looking to make sure that businesses are, you know, better business examples. We want to make sure that folks who we recommend have the capacity to serve military families, that there's a lot of goodwill out there, but oftentimes it's hard to identify with somebody if they don't understand your lifestyle. So we look at things, it's multifaceted, want to make sure that we're not recreating the wheel, that we're pushing people to resources that are out there. There are YMCAs that have wonderful programs for military families. Let folks know about those. I could list on forever. Yes.
Okay, Laura, one of the things that just occurred to me is that since you've been in, Laura, has technology improved your life? I mean, in the way that you can connect with these kinds of things. I understand that you found out about this on Facebook. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, really, technology has totally changed. Even like an experience of a deployment, you know, now I can talk to my husband by Skype, for example, if he was deployed, and that wasn't the case when we started off. But yeah, as far as finding information online through especially the social media, all of the military installations now have social media sites, Facebook and Twitter and so on and so forth. So you can find information so much more easily now than it used to be when I first was associated with the military.
Well, in the couple of minutes that I have left, can I just ask you more broadly, what are some of the other things that would support, Laura, that would support you as a military family and you in general? I mean, apart from this app, can you just tell me some things that people, particularly who aren't sharing your burden, can do to help share that burden?
I think that there needs to be more support groups for soldiers and families going through medical transition. I think the Army has a great hold on the transition process from what I've seen. But as far as going through medical transition, that's one thing I haven't really found were as many support groups or support sources for those going through a medical transition.
Mm. Michelle, what about you? More broadly, what are some of the other things? I mean, I think it's important to remember we live in a time when a lot of people have no experience with military service anymore. So could you just take this opportunity to tell, you know, everybody else, like, what are some of the things that you think would be helpful if
Absolutely.
You want to support these families?
Sure thing. Mental health counseling is one of the top items on our list. The nation at a whole is short mental health providers, but definitely those that understand military families and the struggles that they face. We need more recognition in communities of who our military families are. Most military families live outside of a traditional brick-and-mortar military installation, and so knowing the kids in your school who are military-connected, or the kids on your soccer team, or the military spouses that you employ are very, very important, and offer those families some flexibility.
Well, thank you both again for this, you know, important work. You can't remind people that, you know, these families are serving too, and it behooves people to recognize that and to thank them, not just with words, as I am doing now, and thank you for indulging me, but thank you and for educating us about the ways that we can better support these families. Michelle Joyner is the Communications Director for the National Military Family Association. Laura Yates is a volunteer for the NMFA, and she's also a military spouse. She joined us from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
And Laura, my very best to you and your family on this next phase of your lives.
Thank you so much. And also, thank you so much for the many organizations that are supporting military families out there, like the National Military Family Association.
Next, we're going to meet a little girl in Huntsville, Alabama. She was born without fingers on one hand. And now, thanks to 3D printing technology, she has an affordable prosthetic. As Dan Carson of member station WBHM reports, her story is one example of life-altering changes on the horizon.
Kate Burkholz is a smiley, active 2-year-old who's happy to have a new tool that helps her pick things up. Right now, she's trying very hard to hold still before a gymnastics class.
Can you tell me your name?
Kate Burkholz.
Do you like to run around and play here?
Yeah.
Okay, go.
Those fast feet hint at hurdles for people who need or manufacture pediatric prosthetics. Kids are hard to keep still for fittings. They reject things. They lose things. Most consistently, they grow. And prosthetics made in traditional ways are expensive, says tech entrepreneur Jason Hundley.
The barrier to entry is, you know, the cost for the normal industry. You're talking something that's in the five-figure range. You're talking like the price of a car. That's crazy. Especially, you know, when it's going to not be useful in 6 months to a year.
Enter 3D printing. This is the microwave oven-sized printer that made Kate's plastic hand. Since key patents expired several years ago, printers like it are much cheaper. Basic models are a few hundred dollars. Small businesses, researchers, and regular people have them. That and expertise from Hundley's firm are why Kate has a working, affordable prosthetic. Here's Kate's mom, Jessica Burkholz.
This is huge for our family and for other families because it's not a commitment. It's not, you know, fighting with an insurance company or spending thousands of dollars on a prosthesis that your kid might not want or use. She loses one, and it's not that big a deal. It's $5, and so I can call over to Jason, and he can print us a new one for $5.
Jason Hundley's firm, Zero Point Frontiers, took on the project for free with the goal of sharing the design. Intern Sean Betts did much of the work, with help from company engineers and an online design archive called Thingiverse. Now that Betts has refined several prototypes, he says making a hand for Kate is easy.
A day or two to print one out and assemble it. You've got to print out all the parts and then just pop some pins in place and run some wires through it. But it's a very simple process.
Kate bends her wrist to pull those wires and plastic fingers grasp. The ease of 3D printing means low cost, low risk, and high adaptability. The plans can be scaled up as children grow or customized to fit unique limbs or even unique situations. Hundley plans to make a paddle when Kate learns to swim, but that's not all.
We've talked about modularizing it, you know, for lack of a better term, like a Swiss Army knife. We're talking maybe just make a locked hand so she can ride a bike. And you could do that with a 3D printing because my cost of printing the plastic on that is like 60 cents. Print it, see if it works. If it doesn't work, interchange it.
That's doable because there's no packaging, no shipping, no factory, and no paying engineers to find the cheapest way to make, say, 10,000 units to recoup all those costs. Again, Jason Hundley.
When you can get a fully automated, robotic, neural-controlled prosthetic for $5, that'll be fun.
How far away is that?
Probably about 10 years.
Researchers have already connected sensors to nerves so people can feel through prosthetics, and some are gearing up to print organs. But right now, a simple plastic printed hand is making a little girl and her parents happy as she picks things up in ways she couldn't before. For NPR News, I'm Dan Carson.
Raise your hand if you've been on the Google Flu Trends site today. Okay, raise your hand if you even knew the Google Flu Trends site existed. Well, it does, and if you go to the site today, you'll see that flu season seems to be winding down. There's a somewhat less rosy picture from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website, though. That's where the official flu information is reported, though it's a couple of weeks old. Google started its flu site in 2008 to provide more up-to-date information, but a report in Science magazine finds that quicker isn't necessarily better, NPR's Richard Harris reports.
A few years ago, scientists at Google realized that they could measure flu activity by tracking when people searched for flu-related terms. They created a handy site called Google Flu Trends, and it works pretty well some of the time, but don't bank on it.
It missed by a huge amount last year, and actually, as it turns out, it's been missing by a fair amount for several years.
David Lazar is a professor of political science and computer science at Northeastern University. He says Google Flu Trend whiffed during the 2013 flu season.
This is like bases loaded and bottom of the ninth and, you know, striking out on three pitches. They predicted more than twice as many flu cases as the CDC later said there were.
Lazar has written a critique of Google Flu Trends in the latest issue of Science magazine. He finds that the data collected painstakingly from around the country and forwarded along to the CDC is still much better, even with the time lag.
You could just have used old CDC data, let's say 2 or 3 weeks old, and have projected forward and done a better job than Google Flu Trends.
Is this a useless exercise then?
Not at all. Not at all. I think actually the core idea is a terrific one.
Lazar thinks Google could improve its system with the help of outside scientists if it were less secretive about what exactly it's doing to get its results. But he sees some inherent issues as well. Google is always refining its search methods, which is good for people doing Google searches, but not so good for analyzing that data. Consistency is important in science. Andrea Dugas, who's an emergency room physician and a professor at the Johns Hopkins Medical School, says Google Flu Trends is going after an important problem.
If we knew ahead of time, okay, flu is going to, you know, really peak in the next few weeks, we need to start getting additional resources to help manage all of these patients that are going to be coming in.
During past outbreaks, Hopkins has actually opened up new areas of the hospital to care for flu patients. Dr. Dugas and her colleagues have been working to improve those predictions, looking at various different methods to do that.
The most accurate of those models was the one that looked at the confirmed flu cases. That one was the most accurate predicting what was going to happen in the following week.
When they added in the Google Flu Trends data, their prediction got slightly better.
Adding that in really kind of helped refine the model and give us a better prediction, but the main driver for that was the number of flu cases.
She and colleagues developed an app for hospitals to use to predict the ebb and flow of flu. Dr. Dugas says Google's approach is no substitute for lab tests, hospital reports, and on-the-ground data. And it's important to note that it's not tracking actual flu, just searches of common symptoms like fever, cough, and sore throat. Google didn't provide a scientist a comment for this story, but a Google report notes that part of the issue was that they sometimes get a flood of searches simply when there's a lot of flu in the news. So they updated the flu tracker system this past fall to help reduce the errors that result from that. Richard Harris, NPR News.
The retail giant Target is still reeling from a massive breach of its payment systems during last year's holiday shopping season. Hackers stole 40 million credit and debit card numbers and tens of millions of other pieces of personal information, addresses, phone numbers, and more. The company faces more than 90 lawsuits and has already spent tens of millions of dollars dealing with the fallout from the breach. And now a Bloomberg Businessweek story out today contends that Target itself could have prevented the attack. Mike Riley is co-author of that story, and he joins me here in our studios. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
And let's go back and explain. You found out that 6 months prior to the attack, Target had installed a very sophisticated malware detection system called FireEye, which actually worked exactly as it was intended to work. Tell us a bit about the system and what happened with it.
Yeah, security systems are changing, and this is one of the sort of cutting-edge, really sort of behavior-based ones. The interesting thing about it was initially funded by the CIA. What it does is it essentially sets a series of virtual computers. Anything that's coming into Target's network in terms of data goes through these virtual computers, which are configured exactly like Target's own computers. So essentially what it does is it tricks the hackers into believing that they are in Target's networks. It also has this nice trick where it can advance the clock of a computer. So when malware comes into a network, it can actually see what happens to the malware over a period of days, weeks, or even years in a split second. Once that starts to happen, it sends out an alert that says, hey, there's a piece of hacking malware in your system. You should go fix it.
And that's what happened here. This detection system did exactly that, right? Told Target something bad is going on here.
That's right. That part of the function worked. So on November 30th, and keep in mind, this is before any of the data leaves Target's network, the alerts begin to go off. And for some reason that's not clear, Target didn't act on it in time.
So these malware detection alerts are coming in November 30th, December 2nd. Target says they weren't alerted about the breach until December 12th by federal authorities. They don't tell consumers until December 19th. Why the delay?
That's right. Well, whatever was going on inside Target's security team, they didn't recognize this as a serious breach. There was no serious investigation that went on. They didn't go to the server itself to figure out what the malware was doing. What they've said publicly is that they didn't know anything about the hack until the U.S. Attorney and the Secret Service knocked on their door on December 12th and said, you've got a problem. And it takes them about 3 days to figure out that all this malware is not just on that one server, but on every single or many, many POS systems through their entire store network in the United States.
You write in your story, Mike, Target stood by as 40 million credit card numbers gushed pushed out of its mainframes. You asked them for a response to your story. What did they tell you?
You know, the response was pretty minimal. They pointed out that they are doing a complete review of the security systems that they have in place and that they are trying to figure out how to improve those systems. At this point, it's really the lawyers have sort of taken control of what their response can or should be.
It does seem that, I mean, if Target was aware of a massive breach like this with these huge implications for them, they would have done something about it. I mean, they would have acted if they had known the seriousness of the problem.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I don't think they knew exactly what was going on. It's one thing to sort of get an alert from a system that says you may have malware on your server. It's an entirely different thing to know that 40 million credit cards are leaving your network. It's not that they sat by while they watched 40 million credit cards go out. No responsible company is going to do that. But they had all the pieces of the puzzle. They'd simply put them together. They could have stopped this.
We've been focusing on the hack itself, but let's talk also about the hackers, because
sure.
You do a lot of reporting on who they are. Your research led to Ukraine and Russia, to cyber gangs notorious for their successes in just these kinds of breaches. Who are these people, and why can't the U.S. go after them?
It's a very boisterous, very well-oiled machine, and there are literally millions and millions of credit cards that are stolen around the world every day. They have a very good system for distributing, selling, repackaging. One of the ways that it works is once the credit cards are stolen, they get posted on quarter websites. These are websites that really look like Amazon.com. Hmm. They'll run anywhere from $8 to $50, depending on the quality of the cards, things like the credit limit. And then you'll pop them into an electronic basket, just like Amazon, and check out. It's a fascinating world to look in. It's just fascinating to see how efficient this is. On some level, these guys have found the perfect crime. You can sit and hack a major Fortune 500 company from your couch in Ukraine. You can steal data that has value. You can sell that value on an automated website. You can make money from it, and you're really not at much risk.
Mike Riley, reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Mike's the co-author of the cover story, Easy Target. It's online today and hits newsstands tomorrow.
In its standoff with Ukraine, Russia has imposed its will, but it's tried to hide its hand. Russian troops moved into Crimea, but in uniforms bearing no Russian insignia. And there are other tools Russia is believed to have used that leave virtually no trace: cyber operations. They're part of the modern arsenal. Now U.S. officials want to know if the use of cyber weapons could lead to cyber war. Here's NPR National Security Editor Bruce Oster.
Like some conventional military weapons, cyber ops have names, evocative names. What's being used in Ukraine is no exception. There's Snake. That's a malware tool. It hides on a computer network and steals information. And Snake goes by a bunch of names. There's Ouroboros, Greek for a serpent in mythology. It's also called Agent BTZ, a label with no mythological meaning whatsoever. No matter what it's called, it's important enough that American officials won't talk about it publicly.
In terms of specifics, I would respectfully ask if this is something that would perhaps be best shared in a classified setting.
That's Vice Admiral Michael Rogers. He was testifying to Congress this week because he's been picked to lead the U.S. Cyber Command. And while he wouldn't get into specifics, he left no doubt that conflict today means computers, not just troops and tanks.
Clearly, cyber will be an element of almost any crisis we're going to see in the future.
And in Ukraine, the term cyber covers a multitude of sins. There are reports that Ukrainian politicians had their phones blocked and that Russian troops cut the cables of telecom equipment. Websites have been defaced. Ukraine has done this to Russia, substituting the word Nazi for Russian. Think of this as cyber graffiti.
Not hard to do, pretty simplistic.
Laura Galante is an intelligence analyst with the cybersecurity firm FireEye. She thinks that the use of the sophisticated malware Snake shows that a serious player, like Russia, is in the game. There's evidence snakes lurked on Ukraine's government network since long before the current conflict, a sign that cyber operations are happening all the time, war or peace. A version has also been linked to a break-in of secret Pentagon computers back in 2008. Its use now in Ukraine has experts paying attention.
People think, oh, wow, here's a window into Russia's cyber capabilities.
Again, Laura Galante.
Russia's long been vaunted as this uber-capable, almost boogeyman of an actor. They're so good, we just don't see them. So any data points that us in the analytic community can use to understand Russia's real capabilities would be massively useful.
Now, Snake is not cyber war. It's a kind of intelligence gathering. but will Russia cross the line? Will it venture into outright cyber war? It's hard to answer that question. The rules for cyber war have yet to be written. Catherine Lotriante is director of the Institute for Law, Science, and Global Security at Georgetown University. She says the rules could be taking shape right in front of our eyes.
And so watching how the Russia-Ukraine conflict rolls out will tell us a lot about the practice that states are going to be conducting in the cyber realm when it comes to conflict and what rules they're comfortable with accepting or not.
Rules like, how do you know when force has been used? What's a legitimate target? Even what's a weapon? Clearly, there's a lot to work out. Bruce Auster, NPR News, Washington.